This is the Reading Envy Podcast, where we'll have what you're reading.
Hi, I'm Jenny, and I'm at the Reading Envy Pub, and an old friend has stopped by. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jenny.
Jason returns to the podcast from episode 14 from last year, so I'm glad to have you back.
I'm glad to be back.
So, what have you been doing?
Well, I think we recorded that other episode back in October, and since then, I have planted, let's see, I think I did 200 collards, about 200 cabbage, and around 150 or so broccoli plants, and of course, a whole ton of other stuff, rutabagas, turnips, kale, spinach, anything you can think of like that. Had a pretty successful fall and winter growing season. I picked some turnips today, still getting some of them on, and collards, and been trying to get the garden ready for the spring season coming up. And wintertime is more of a downtime in the gardening realm of things. And whenever I'm not doing that, I am you could call me a scrapper, and basically my version of being a scrapper is I go and pick up aluminum cans off the side of the road. So I do that maybe one day out of the week. That brings you a little bit of enjoyment and cash. So whenever I'm not doing either one of those things, I'm of course reading and working on becoming an aspiring writer. So
wonderful.
There you go.
So have you started planting in the spring? Like, I don't know how early the early stuff starts.
Well, you can. I follow by the Farmer's Almanac pretty religiously. I can veer off sometimes, but you can. Right now is an okay time. I mean, I got a good buddy that's already planted a few acres of corn, but it's a little bit early for that for me, because I have to put so much money into seeds and plants and different things, and of course organic fertilizers are much more expensive than just normal good old 10-10-10. I'm gonna wait with most of my stuff. My target date is 22nd of April. That will be a day from sun up to sundown, and maybe a little bit before and after that I will be in the dirt. So that's going to be my big planting day. Already got 70 tomato plants pre-ordered. So there you go.
I have a really small backyard, but I have a few raised beds in there.
Yeah.
Well, I'm down to one because the wood rotted because it's untreated wood.
Mm-hmm.
So I have this one bed and I'm trying to decide what I'm going to put in there. So we'll see.
Yeah, you'll get it figured out.
Yeah. That's fun. I was like hearing about that. It's such a massive undertaking.
It is, but you know, it's fun, and I the only like machinery that I use, I mean, I don't have a tractor and all that jazz. I have a very large rear tine tiller, and that's about my only means of breaking up the ground. So I try to stick as close to the old time methods as I can. And that's the only, if I didn't have the tiller, I'd be doing like my great grandfather did with the mule and the plow. So I think I'm pretty close to the old time way.
Yeah, that's great. So I guess we can talk about some of the books we've been reading. I guess I can start.
Okay.
So true confession, I think I own four versions of this book. I'm not sure why. I just like, I'll come across a different edition and I'm like, ooh, that's nice. And then I buy it and I come home and I'm like, oh yeah, I already had that book. It is Justine by Lawrence Durrell. Mm-hmm. And it's the first book of the Alexandria Quartet, and it's written in 1957. And so I first read this book a couple of years back, and I fell in love with the language. And then I never read the rest of the books in that quartet. Mm-hmm. Well, I think at one point I read the second one, but I've never read all four, and I always meant to. And then this year I got all four in audio. And yeah. So I listened to Justine again. So I've made it as far as I've always made it. But I have high hopes this year that I'm going to actually listen to all of them. I'm going to make it through the quartet. It's one of my goals I have for myself. But these books, the writing is just gorgeous. And so I wanted to read a little bit from here, but maybe I should say what it's about. And that's what I'm kind of struggling with. I mean, it's this one, of course, is about Justine and the author who writes, who's never named in this book. He has a name, I understand, later on in some of the other books. Mm-hmm. He has a relationship with her and a relationship with other people, and they're trying to hide the relationship with Justine. And then she disappears at one point. And it's all set in the city of Alexandria, but before World War II. So it's very, the culture is very based on Europeans mixing with people who are actually Egyptians. And the descriptions of the city are amazing. And it's almost like the city is its own character. And I think that's probably what I love the most. I mean, the character of Justine is really intriguing, and all the, like, the love triangle parts are kind of fun. But every time, I think the book gets about 3/4 of the way, and then I kind of lose track about what's actually going on.
Yeah, okay.
So I can't even really tell you what happens in the end, except for that the beginning of the book, I think, happens after the end, where he's taking care of the child of one of the women. And it seems like that woman must not be around anymore. And you don't really know why, and you don't understand, you know, like, the backstory. So the book kind of serves as that, I guess.
Okay.
I'd say. And actually, the book I'm reading from, have you ever seen the Penguin Ink imprint?
Yeah, they got almost, it's like a tattoo looking cover almost. Yeah, they're really cool looking.
They're gorgeous. And so every time I find one, I've been trying to collect them all. So there just happens to be a version of Justine. So that's what I'm reading from, because I couldn't very well read from the audiobook.
Okay, that's right. Okay.
So first I'm going to read just a little bit about Alexandria so you can kind of get an idea of how the author writes about the city.
Okay.
5 races, 5 languages, 12 creeds, 5 fleets turning through their greasy reflections behind the harbor bar. But there are more than 5 sexes, and only demotic Greek seems to distinguish among them. The sexual provender which lies to hand is staggering in its variety and profusion. You would never mistake it for a happy place. I remember Nassim once saying, I think he was quoting, that Alexandria was the great winepress of love. Those who emerged from it were the sick men, the solitaries, the prophets. I mean, all who have been deeply wounded. So that's a little bit of that.
Yeah.
And just kind of another little kind of intro to the relationship part, just like on page 8. I'm thinking back to the time when, for the 4 of us, the known world hardly existed. Days became simply the spaces between dreams, spaces between the shifting floors of time, of acting, of living out the topical, a tide of meaningless affairs nosing among the dead level of things, entering no climate, leading us nowhere, demanding of us nothing save the impossible, that we should be. Justine would say that we had been trapped in the projection of a will too powerful and too deliberate to be human. The gravitational field which Alexandria threw down about those it had chosen as its exemplars. So you can tell that the language is part of the draw. Well, yeah, I hope you can tell.
Very fluid and beautiful.
Yeah, it's very lyrical. And I remember the first time I read this, I think that was 2008 or 2009. I immediately went back to the beginning and just read the beginning few pages out loud again. That's how much it just kind of caught me right away. So
yeah. So you want me to talk about my first book?
Sure, please.
Oh, all right. My first book that I want to discuss and talk about is One More Thing, Stories and Other Stories by B.J. Novak. And if you've ever watched The Office, you know who B.J. Novak is. He played Ryan the intern, if I'm thinking right.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote, B.J. Novak actually wrote I don't have the statistics, but I know he wrote a great many episodes of The Office. He really did that, a very comedic writer. And his first book, I think this book came out I believe February or March or so of last year. And I got it because I really liked The Office. I was a big fan of The Office, and I really liked, seemed to have a particular draw to the episodes he had written. So, of course, whenever I found out he had a book come out, that was on my list of my to-buy list. So I definitely I enjoyed it. That is to say the least. Most of the stories in it, and there is a bunch of short stories. I should have counted beforehand, but there has to be well over 50 short stories in the collection, but some of them, I mean, there's one or two that are only three lines long. It's almost like he just had the punchline to a joke, but some are, you would expect most of them to be very, very funny, and they are. There are some, it has a very powerful thing, I think, essence to this book that you can go back, you can read one of the stories and actually laugh out loud in it, which is not something I do too often with any book, and then come back a few weeks later and read it again and laugh again. I think that's a very powerful thing to be able to do. And anyway, I just thought I'd read a few little stories out of it.
Please.
These first two that I'm going to read are linked. First story kind of, it gives you the setup for the second story, and there's a few stories in between these two, so you kind of don't really think about that other one too much. You go along in the collection, and then this just kind of hits you. And the first one is called All You Have to Do. I wear a bright red t-shirt every single day. I've been doing it for years. That's all you have to do to meet the girl of your dreams. It sounds easy, doesn't it? It is. That's exactly my point. Wearing a red t-shirt is the hardest part of it all, and it's as easy as could be. Once I have the red t-shirt on, I just live my life exactly the way I want to live it. Maybe I take my dog for a walk in the park. If there's a new bar or restaurant I've heard about, I might go and check that place out. If there are any friends I want to catch up with, I might grab a bite or a drink there with them. But there's also nothing wrong with going to a restaurant or bar by yourself. In some ways, that's even better. I wear one with a pocket, but it doesn't matter. Bright red is the thing. Then when you're done living your life for the day, you just go to this website called Miss Connection and type in red shirt. Don't put it in quotes, because some people might say red t-shirt without a hyphen, and some others might spell it T-E-E or some other little variation. There's no one right way to spell t-shirt, so just type red shirt. It will take a little bit of extra time, but that way you'll be sure not to miss anything. Then you see who likes you. More important, who likes you for you. Not you changing your behavior to impress anyone or please anyone. Not you on date behavior. Just you being you. And anyone will tell you that's the whole point. You want to meet someone who likes the same things you do and who likes you most when you're most being yourself. So that, when you are in a relationship, the person will truly be compatible with the real you. That's all you have to do. It really is that simple. Now, when someone does contact you, and it seems like it might be a match, you should wear another shirt on the date besides the red t-shirt, so it doesn't seem like you only have one shirt. Or should you wear the red t-shirt as always, in case the first date doesn't go well and you want a simple way to check if you caught anyone else's interest while you were out on the date? That is a very interesting question, and one I think about a lot. I will let you know what I do when that comes up. And that's the first one. And I really liked it. I thought it was interesting. It's funny a little bit and interesting, and kind of it'll lead into the second one. And I really liked how these two were linked. And the second one is Missed Connection, Grocery Spill at 21st and 6, 2:30 p.m. on Wednesday. I was outside the Trader Joe's at 21st and 6 around 2:30 p.m. last Wednesday. I was wearing oversized sunglasses and a small straw fedora hat, light blue jeans, a black t-shirt-like top, and freshly washed shoulder-length dirty blonde hair with bangs. I'm 29, but people sometimes guess I'm anywhere from 28 to 30. I was carrying two paper grocery bags. You were walking by me in the opposite direction, carrying groceries too, but only one bag. You asked if you could help, and when I tried to explain, then your hands would be just as full as mine. I dropped a bottle of salsa, red, medium spicy Trader Joe's brand, or Trader Jose's, as you corrected me. But it didn't shatter, which we both found interesting. I told you my name was Lila, L-I-L-A, and you told me you had a cousin who pronounced it the same way but spelled it differently, L-E-I-L-A. It turned out we were both from the same area code in New Jersey, 551. And we talked about our hometowns for a bit and that diner where everyone used to go after games in high school. Then you walked me home carrying one of my two bags, even though I said it made no sense to. And you insisted on bringing them all the way inside for me. And then I made a pot of coffee, even though I was only making one cup for you. And then you explained about French presses and Keurig machines. Then we both looked at the clock at the same time and realized we had somehow been talking about coffee for over an hour. You looked in my eyes and said it felt like we had somehow known each other for a long time, and I said, I agree. And then we made out on my green quilted couch with a blue stain on the left armrest. And after our very first kiss, you pulled away from me and caught your breath and just said the word electric. Then you kissed me again, and we made out until we both looked at the clock at the same time again and realized we had been making out for 3 hours. Then we watched Iron Chef together and then Planet Earth, the African Plains episode, and we both agreed how that was just totally the jackpot Planet Earth because so many are about jellyfish or algae, but all anyone really wants to see are giraffes and monkeys and elephants, etc. I said I didn't want you to leave, and you said me neither. And you slept over at my place and borrowed navy blue pajamas with yellow stripes and a hole in the left knee. But when my brother visited me and we both said we weren't cuddlers, but we cuddled anyway for almost an hour. And then finally you slept on the left side of the bed, which was perfect because I sleep on the right. I slept on my back, which you said was pretentious. I said, what do you mean? That's just how I sleep. How can it be pretentious? And you said, like you think you're a beautiful angel or something. And I said, maybe you're just really into me. And we kissed again. And then you turned to sleep on your stomach with your head facing left. And I said, doesn't that hurt your neck? And you said, for some reason, usually not, but sometimes yes. And that your fantasy when you were a kid was to get a bed with a hollowed out hole straight down from the pillow so you could sleep with your head face down and straight, and I said, like a massage chair. And it turned out you had never had a massage, so I said, let's go this weekend so you could check out if it was similar to what you had been thinking of as a kid. And if it's how you want to sleep, it'd be weird, but hey, it's your life. And you laughed and said, deal twice. Deal, deal. Like that. Then you realized your phone, a Motorola, had died and I didn't have the right charger. And you said that's probably a sign that you should get going anyway and take care of some stuff at home. And I said, cool. And then we made a plan that you'd come over on Friday and I'd have to cook a dinner that included every single ingredient that I had in those Trader Joe's bags, Iron Chef style. But then the next day you didn't come over or call to explain why or reschedule. I know that I gave you my number, but now I realize that sometimes I write numbers and scribble. especially when I'm excited, which I was. So maybe you haven't been able to decode it or left a message for the wrong number. I know this sounds crazy to say after one encounter, but I kind of fell for you pretty hard, and it has been forever since I connected to anyone like this, and my heart is kind of broken in a million pieces. Hit me up if you think anything in this description matches anything you remember. And if so, maybe we can chill sometime. You were wearing a red t-shirt with a pocket. So it was the dude. I really liked that. That was I liked how those two were kind of linked up. And this one will take me 2 seconds to do. I like this one. Kindness among cakes. Child. Why does carrot cake have the best icing? Mother. Because it needs the best icing. I like that one. And my absolute favorite one, I know I've been talking a long, long time, but my absolute favorite one, I like this one. The walk to school on the day after Labor Day. I was sad that summer was over, but I was happy that it was over for my enemies, too. I like how he's got this little wit to him. And, you know, it really does seem like a little like things that didn't make it into the office. It really does.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually have read this book, but I listened to the audio and he has different people reading the different types of stories. And it's really fun in audio too.
I bet. So, and one more. Now this was another one that I liked. It's called If You Love Something. If you love something, let it go. If you don't love something, definitely let it go. Basically, just drop everything. Who cares? So, yeah, I really enjoyed that book. I thought it was very comical. And some what surprised me is some of the stories in there, you know, they have this kind of, they're funny, but after you finish reading them and think about it for a minute or two, it kind of had a really serious undertone to it that just kind of sneaks up on you. And I like how he was able to do that. So
yeah, like the carrot cake.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, because it seems funny at first, and then you think about it, yeah, it kind of does need a lot of ice. So yeah. But anyway, I'm sorry that took so long, but I had to give some love to BJ Novak for that book, because I truly, truly, truly enjoyed it.
Yeah, great book. So my second one is called The World Until Yesterday, What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies by Jared Diamond. He's the author of Guns, Germs, and Steel, which I think most people know.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of it. I've never read it, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I've heard of it too, but never read it. This is my first book I've read by him. So this year I'm reading a lot of books, well, it's supposed to be Oceania, but I haven't made it outside of New Guinea yet.
Okay.
So this is another book that is tangentially about New Guinea. I guess the author says he spends 7% of his life. I guess he has it down to a formula. 7% of his life in Papua New Guinea, in various different places. He goes back and forth between the highlands and the sea area. So I would say that maybe half of the examples in the book are about different tribes in Papua New Guinea, different people groups, different families. And then he uses a lot of research from other anthropologists and even some of his own research from other places, just from all over, just societies that would be considered primitive compared to ours. And I don't really have a good example to read because in general, he picks a topic and then he discusses it. So it's hard to find a paragraph that's really exemplary of that. But gosh, I just felt like I learned a lot. And I've been talking about this book a lot to people, and this isn't the type of thing I usually read. So it's just been kind of interesting to delve into it. I think there's a lot to be said about primitive societies and how they raise children is a big one. Of course, diet is one we hear about a lot with paleo craze and everything. Mm-hmm. Treatment of old people and how some diseases are unique to the developing world or developed world compared to more primitive societies. Like, they don't struggle with diabetes or heart disease. And, you know, of course they have these other sets of diseases. Yeah. But I mean, it's a thick book. I feel like I learned a lot. It was interesting because, of course, Papua New Guinea has 700 different languages itself, or 1,000. I mean, it's a crazy, crazy number for this, the landmass that it has. So of course, with that many different languages, there's also going to be a lot of different practices among the groups. So it's not like New Guineans are all the same by any means. Yeah. So he uses very specific examples, like how the Dani fight in war, and how the Highlanders raise their children and things like that. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. It's a very widely encompassing book. And it's a little critical, I think, of the developed world, too, for taking things too far and not balancing out advancement with things that actually made sense to do. Mm-hmm. And he calls it neo-localism, how we all, you know, move and relocate with our immediate family and we lose the ties with the rest of our families. And
yeah.
I mean, not everyone does, but I know I have, a lot of us do, and kind of how we suffer for that and how our culture suffers for that. And,
that's a lot of sense.
Yeah. It's really interesting. I know my, I have 24 first cousins.
Wow.
So growing up, I didn't see them all the time, but like holidays, you know, were massive affairs with tons and tons of people. So some of what I was reading, it felt familiar to me just in that kind of environment. Maybe not the eating sweet potatoes for 90% of my diet or hunting down the wild boar, but, you know, having this large, massive family where for the most part, everyone had a shared belief system and a kind of just a shared way of being.
I got it. Yeah, it makes sense. It does. That's amazing. What, did you say 24?
Yeah, I mean, if you count both sides.
God.
I know.
I have three.
Yeah. Well, and now I'm like the oldest girl, but a lot of them are married and have kids of their own. And
wow.
It's just a massive group.
Sounds like it. So you're not reading that one?
No.
No. Okay. No good. Like I said, no good examples. Okay. So are you wanting me to go to the next book now?
Yeah, sure. I don't think I have much more to say about this, but I just have a few more books that I might read for Papua New Guinea, but I think I'm coming to the end of that island for now.
Yeah, that's something I've always had a hard time doing. I need to expand my horizons on the reading world. I tend to that's something I really need to work on, because I tend to not, you know, read anything that doesn't have to do with America or around in the South or something. You know, of course, as you know, I'm very attached to Southern fiction, and I do struggle with that in my own reading habits, you know, not reading things, you know, out of the little circle that I like. Mm. I respect your reading habit or your reading venture there to go to different places.
It's been very interesting, that's for sure.
I imagine so.
So sure, what other books did you want to talk about?
Okay, the next one I want to get to is it's a short story collection called Battleborn, and the author is Claire V. Watkins, and it came out, I think, in 2012, and it's a really interesting collection. It most of the stories are set in Nevada or in and around over in, out west for sure, if they're not set in Nevada, and they kind of are rough and gritty and tough short stories, and I really enjoyed it because I'm used to my grit lit with the Southern reads, and I was surprised to find a Western writer that kind of, you know, had those same tones and styles as Southern writers do. So I enjoyed it. Most of them were in first person, which I must say I tend to go third person in my reading most of the time. But these were exceptionally written, and I enjoyed them. An interesting side note about the author: her father was one of Charles Manson's right hand men. Back in the day whenever all that was going on, so she had a hard time, you know, dealing with that. I know it was one interview I read whenever the book came out. You know, she said that usually once a year, since she's, you know, had enough sense to know what was going on in the world from being a little girl. Usually once a year, you know, some journalist or a reporter seeks her out and, you know, wants her side of the story on Charles Manson and having to deal with that and deal with her, you know, mother being involved and everything and father and just all kinds of crazy stuff. And that you can tell that kind of goes on to the page and the written word. But the short story that I wanted to read just a page and a half from is called The Diggings, and it's basically about the whole California gold rush thing back I'm so bad at history, back in whatever year the California gold rush happened. I sound intelligent right now. Anyway, it's called The Diggings. There were stories in the territory. Stories that could turn a sane man sour and a sour man worse. Three Frenchmen in Coloma dug up a stump to make way for a road and panned $2,000 in plates from the hole. Above the Feather River, a Michigander, that's a tough word there, my lord, I'm really sounding bad here, a Michigander lawyer staked his mule for the night, and when he pulled it in the morning, a vein winked up at it. Down on the Tullahoma and Hoosier, survived a gunfight and found his fortune in a hole of the bullet drilled in the rock above his shoulder. In Rough and Ready, a man called Vinegar Raspberry, aiming to free a ramrod jammed in his musket, fired at random into the exposed root of a manzanita bush. There he found $5,000 in gold, free and pure. Near Carson Creek in Massachusetts, man died of eczema sickness, and mourner shoveled up a 7-pound nugget while digging his grave. And California gold was what God was in the rest of the country. Everything, everywhere. My brother Errol told of a man on a stool beside him who bought a round with a pinch of dust. He told of a child dwelling in a gully who found a queerly colored rock and took it to his mother, who boiled it with lye in her tea kettle for a day to be sure of its composition. He told of a drunkard pike who had found a lake whose shore sparkled with stuff but could not, once sober, retrieve the memory of where it was. There were men drowning in color, men who could not walk into the woods to empty their bladders without shouting Eureka. And there were those who had nothing. There were those who worked like slaves every single day. Those who had attended expensive lectures on geology and chemistry back home. Those who had absorbed every manual on the passage westward. Put to memory every map of those sinister foothills. Scrutinize every speck of filth and territory offered. And in the end were rewarded without so much as a glinting in their pants. And there was a third category of miner, too, more wretched and volatile than the others, the luckless belief. Here was a 49er ever poised on the cusp of having class, his strike a breath away in his mind. Belief was his dangerous sickness at the diggings. It made a man greedy, violent, and insane. This fever burned hotter within my brother than in any other prospector among the placers. I know because I lit it. Hmm. So yeah, it's pretty serious and intense, and a lot of very big and hard words to pronounce for an old Southern boy. But despite my my mispronunciations, it is a very very deep and violent short story. I'm just going to put it that way. I really enjoyed it. It was. I do have a confession to make. For a good while in my early reading life, I tended to stick to male authors for some unknown reason. I don't really know why. It wasn't something that I did on purpose. It just kind of happened that way. And I've been trying to read a lot more. In fact, last year I counted up all the books I read last year, and I read, I believe, 27 books by male authors and 32 by females. So I'm getting in more on the lady side.
And, yeah, that's good.
I have definitely been enjoying reading a Cormac McCarthy tone and in a female writer. So I really enjoyed that collection.
Yeah. So are the other stories in the volume, are they all historical like that, or
there are one or two more? I believe there's one other that are historical, and the others are present day. There's a man finds I believe it's a pill bottle or a wallet on the it's a wallet. That's what it is. He finds a wallet on the side of the road, and you know, of course, finds the man's license and all. And start sending him letters, and the whole story is just this man sending this. It's this man that found the wallet sending the owner of the wallet letters. That's what the whole story comprises of.
Oh, I like that idea.
Yeah, it was so interesting and beautiful, and he would just like, he would select one thing out of the wallet, and, you know, talk about it. It's like this picture with two men and a woman standing together, and he's talking about how he imagined who these people were and what they were to this man, and trying to figure out which one, or you know, all that kind of stuff. It was really really interesting, and you kind of found out during the writing slowly through that the man that found the wallet was a little bit psychotic, so it was interesting. I must say, it's a great collection. It won a good many awards. I think that the Young Lions Award for fiction, and I think she won one of those. Was it Guggenheim? Some of the like the fellowship. I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's what it's called.
Hard words. Today.
Yeah, but, man.
Anyway, yeah,
those are not awarded to very many people.
No, they're not. And and she, I believe, she won that last year, that fellowship. And she's really, I am truly looking forward to whatever she writes next, because that entire collection was just a hard ride on the train. It was it was good.
Yeah, and those kind of fellowships generally come with money, right? So then you can actually spend time working on your craft instead of, you know, just getting an award or something. I guess a lot of awards come with money. But I think that's the intention, is that they give you funding so that you can work on a specific project.
That's right. Yeah.
Because I know some composers who've gotten that same prize.
Mm-hmm.
Neat. It sounds good. I've just never even heard of her.
Yeah, it was one of those books that kind of snuck in under the radar, I think, and I don't even remember how. I honestly can't remember how I found out about it, but I really, really fell in love with it. And like I say, it was, of course, you know, Cormac McCarthy, I'm a huge, huge fan. I almost picked the road to talk about tonight, but I figured it had enough fanfare behind it. But, I'm a big fan of him, and of course, you know, he does a lot of Western writing, and it was almost like reading Cormac McCarthy. It really was, and
that's high praise.
That is high praise coming from me, and I must say it's beautiful. You'll have to check that one out.
So you've been kind of on a short story kick?
Yeah, lately? I have been. I have really, really been on. I don't know why, but I really have. Ever since I read, I discussed that Laura Vandenberg's The Isle mm-hmm. of Youth a little bit in the last time we recorded, and ever since I read that, I've really been on that kick. I've been reading more of rereading some of Ron Rash's short stories and going back over my favorite William Gay. Been going over his stuff again and just kind of, I don't know, I guess I'd kind of got out of the short story thing for a while. And
yeah, I know what you mean, though. It's a certain kind of mood, and I'm not sure exactly what it is, but the attention span is different, and it's not just that they're short, because often they require greater attention than something longer. I don't know.
Absolutely. And there's one I'm really excited to read, and I believe you read it, Megan Mayhew Bergman's Birds of a Lesser Paradise. You remember that book?
Mm-hmm.
It was a couple years ago. Anyway, she had a new collection.
Yes, I haven't read the new one yet. I'm excited to.
Almost Famous Women. That's right.
Yeah.
I have it sitting on my nightstand right now. So that's next after my current read. So.
Yeah, I remember Birds of a. Is it Lesser Paradise?
Birds of a Lesser Paradise.
I know, I say I remember and I can't remember the title, but there's a story in there about this mother and her daughter traveling across the country to go get the bird of the mother's mother who just passed away.
Housewifely art.
Yeah, that story has stuck with me. I don't know. I don't remember any of the others, but that one, I won't forget that one.
Yeah, that was the first one in the collection. Mm-hmm. That was quite I agree. That was one to stick with.
It's amazing. I have to thank you too, because I went and read two books by Laura Vandenberg after we talked about her, because I had never heard of her.
Oh, right.
And I really liked her.
Yeah, and she just came out with a new novel. Find Me.
I read that first, and then I went back and read something like
What the world would look like when all the water what the world will look like when all the water leaves us. There's
right.
a lot of W's.
Yeah, I can never remember titles exactly, but I thought both of them were great.
Well, good. I'm glad you seeked her out. You'll have to check out The Isle of Youth.
Really, yeah. That must be her first one, I guess.
It was the What the World Would Look Like When All the Water Leaves Us. Say that five times fast.
I know.
That was her first one. The Isle of Youth was second, and
Finding
third. So, yeah, you can tell I'm a big fan of her. I got all that memorized.
Well, I'm feeling despair because I picked all male authors today.
Don't feel bad. Let's see. I'm only Claire Bay Watkins. She is my only female too. So don't feel bad.
Well, I try so hard to consciously read female authors that I'm just like, dope, but that's okay. Cause I'm really excited about my last book that I brought. It's Us Conductors by Shawn Michaels. And I had not heard of this book. I don't know how it escaped me. I used to pay so much attention to all the prize winners. And this is the 2014 winner of the Scotiabank Giller Prize, formerly known as just the Giller Prize before they had to get a sponsor. It's basically an award for Canadian lit.
Yeah.
And I think we all need to read more Canadian lit. There's a lot of great authors in Canada that we never hear of.
Yeah, there are.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I was starting to pay attention to it, but I was looking at the award site today and I haven't paid attention for the last 3 years. So apparently I started out meaning well, but I haven't really followed it through. But I found this book in the leisure reading collection at my, the academic library where I work. And I don't know, something about the title and the cover just made me go, ooh, what's this? And it turns out to be the highly fictionalized story, and the author is very clear to say this is lies. These are all lies. It's from the point of view of Leon Therm. Let's see how he says his name. Leon Theremin, who became known as Dr. Theremin, the inventor of the theremin. And it's kind of a love story. He's in love with a woman named Clara, I guess. And he also, he is sent, it's during Soviet times, and he's sent to America to do inventions and to market inventions, but also kind of to be a spy. And then he gets imprisoned in Russia as a traitor. And so they bring him back there. And so it's about all of these things. And I guess I'm just a sucker for novels about music because I have such a music background. And so when authors really understand music, it adds a definite extra dimension to their writing for me. And this author is apparently, he has a really well-known music blog that I actually used to read pretty regularly called Said the Gramophone. And he is a music critic in addition to writing fiction, which I think is an amazing combination.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think part of the thing, part of what I liked about this book is it switches back and forth in between tense or between points of view. I mean, you said that you prefer third person.
Yeah.
One of the things I love about like nonfiction essays is when people flip between like first and second person. Yeah. I feel like it has a really specific purpose, but I don't see it a lot in fiction. And a lot of this novel is in second person. And most of the time, especially later on in the novel, he's talking to Clara because he hears her everywhere. He can hear her voice, basically. But near the beginning, when he's talking about the theremin, I think he just means you as in all of you. So that's the part I'm going to read here. Okay. This is the way you play a theremin. You turn it on, then you wait. You wait for several reasons. You wait to give the tubes the chance to warm, like creatures taking their first breaths. You wait in order to heighten the audience's suspense. And, finally, you wait to magnify your own anticipation. It is a thrill and a terror. You stand before a cabinet and two antennas, and immediately the space itself is activated. The room is charged. The atmosphere is alive. What was potential is potent. You imagine sparks, embers, tiny lightning flecks balanced in the vacant air. You raise your hands. Raise the right hand first, toward the pitch antenna, and you will hear it. A shocked electric ooh, steadying into a long hymn. Raise the left hand toward the volume antenna, and you will quiet it. Move your hands again, and the device will sing. My theremin is a musical instrument, an instrument of the air. Its two antennas emerge from a closed wooden box. The pitch antenna is tall and black, noble. The closer your right hand gets, the higher the theremin's tone. The second antenna controls volume. It is bent, looped, gold, and horizontal. The closer you bring your left hand, the softer the instrument's song. The farther away, the louder it becomes. But always, you are standing with your hands in the air like a conductor. That is the secret of the theremin, after all. Your body is a conductor. So the theremin was developed right before the economy crashed in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So all these things that they thought were going to happen, at least according to the novel, might all be lies. It just didn't, you know, the theremin is probably maybe the best example of electronic music, that whole phase in music. It didn't really get off the ground and become a fixture in every house like they thought it would. And it's such a different sound. And in the novel, this girl, Clara, learns how to play it. So about halfway through, I'm reading and I'm like, okay, I have to go read about theremin a little bit, or I at least need to go listen to some theremin music. It's been a while, you know, it has that very ethereal kind of otherworldly sound to it. I know what it sounds like, but I wanted to hear some music. And the music I found was played by Clara Rockmore, the character in the novel. I just couldn't believe it. I was so excited. So for the whole second half, I listened to theremin music, probably drove everyone in my house crazy, but it just made for an even better experience. I just devoured it, basically.
Yeah, well, it sounds interesting. That little bit that you read, that was beautiful. I'm like you, I you know, Ten. I think Ten House published it.
Yes. No, you're right. Good memory.
And that's how I follow Ten House on Facebook, and that's how I even knew anything about it, because they had, you know, pushed about the, you know, publication, advertised about it. Mm-hmm. Then whenever it won that Canadian award, they really, you know, blew up about it. And that's how I knew about it. That's the only way I would ever knew anything. And you really, I'd honestly, until you mentioned it, I had completely forgot about that book. And I'm going to have to check it out, man.
Yeah, I really liked it. And now I feel like I need to go read some more books about Theremin. And he mentions his sources in the back, too. So.
Oh, man. So, yeah, Amazon's going to be getting hit up.
Yeah.
There you go. All right.
Yeah, it's good, though. Really good book.
Yeah, sounds like it.
And how about you?
Okay, number three for me is going to be called The Blueberry Years. And the author's name is Jim Minnick. I am assuming that I am saying Minnick and pronouncing it correctly, but if not, it is M-I-N-I-C-K. So, sorry, Mr.
Seems
Minnick.
Seems right.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Minnick, if I botched your name. But and it's subtitled A Memoir of Farm and Family. And basically, it's a memoir. It really is. It's a Southern memoir, because it's in Virginia, and he kind of writes with that sort of Southern, I don't know what the word is. I want to use essence or lyrical part. I mean, I guess it's enough to be Southern to just be said in the South, but it just this book really, really resonated with me, because it's about an organic blueberry farm. I grow organic blueberries. It's set in the South, and you know, a lot of it is how he had trouble, you know, getting the whole organic thing pushed through. And I have trouble with that myself, because you know, a lot of people like and enjoy organic, and then you're going to have others, you know, I'll just throw some 10-10-10 and Miracle-Gro on it, it'll be all right. But it was just a really, really, really great memoir. And it was interesting, you know, they planted, I believe it was 1,000 blueberry bushes at one time, and they had, you know, had to have the land prepared, and his wife taught child, I think she taught four-year-old kindergarten. I believe that's what she taught, and then he was a on-again, off-again professor, and they just kind of, when they weren't working, they spent time with the blueberries. And of course, when both of them were off for the summer, and in the main blueberry time, you know, that's what they spent their time doing. So I thought I would just and I did have the pleasure of meeting Mr. Minnick at the first ever South Carolina Book Festival that I went to.
Cool.
So that was a nice little plus to it. So anyway, and I like this quote, and he has published a few books of poetry, and I believe this little bit of I can't even think of what you want to call it right now. It's like a little blurb under the prologue, and it is a globe all ocean with swirling clouds on top a crater, each one hit by a falling star. So I thought that was really pretty, but. Hmm. Here is it. The prologue is about 2.5 pages here, and I just thought I would read it, because it kind of puts a whole, it gives you the scene on everything about the whole blueberry farm and all that. And it's titled The Pickers. They come to fill buckets and pans, cannon jars, freezer bags, pie crusts, and always the ever waiting tongue. They come to visit and eat, to state the hungers of loneliness and body. Though we offer only blueberries, they come wanting more. They come from the American dream, CEOs and wealthy realtors, two kids piling out of just washed SUVs, wives stylish in their special picket outfits. They come from communes named Left Bank, Abundant Dawn, and A Light Morning. They come tie-dyed, shoeless, braless, bathless. On a good day, 30 cars of pickers fill our one-acre field. Strangers and friends all picking side by side. Most come from a distance, driving 20 miles or more just because we're organic. They negotiate the winding dirt road into these Virginia hills. The directions taped on the steering wheel. Their vehicles grind in the last half mile of steep lane. Often they step out of their cars and ask, how did you ever find this place? They bring their children, wild or well-behaved, all fascinated for a little while by a bush with a sweet berry. The toddlers hide in the maze of canes while six-year-olds sneak fruit from their mother's buckets. When scolded, they sit and fill their pails with leaves and green berries. The infants go home pooping blue. One picker travels with her daughter all the way from North Carolina, 3 hours away. They are reading blueberries for Sal. The mother tells me as she pulls up, we just have to see a blueberry bush. The wide-eyed daughter strains in her baby seat and points to the field. Many pickers come 5 times a season, year after year. Others come only once. Some come in Cadillacs and Land Rovers, their cars pitching and scraping on our lane, the hubcaps sparkling like newly minted coins. Some drive 20-year-old Dodges and Fords, the rust as hungry as the driver. They come from France and Germany, Korea and South Africa, Ecuador, Costa Rica and Japan. Once a riding group of Japanese women spilled out of 3 cars to cover the field with quick voices and beautiful smiles. Because it is the last day of the season, they find only 2 or 3 pounds apiece, but still they laugh and sing. One shares a blueberry haiku and says we should open a restaurant here, sell hot dogs. Before any foreigners leave, I ask them to pronounce blueberry in their tongue, and then write in our notebook. And there's a few ways it's pronounced. I'm not going to try to help. Most people harvest for themselves, but some pick for us on shares. A bucket for us, a bucket for them. We'll sell these at market and be glad for the help. Others harvest for restaurants, markets, or CSAs. Community-supported agriculture farms. These pickers come the same day every week, rain or shine. I pick with them through soaking rains. Our slickers and wool sweaters useless. After a while, our fingers wrinkle and numb, too cold to pluck even the biggest berry. Others come to barter with chicken and eggs, lettuce and tomatoes, fresh milk and goat cheese. With one, I trade berries for massages. With another, a year's supplies of berries for our website. Once I even barter berries for a truckload of fleeces. I want to try wool as mulch for the bushes, as if to warm them, as if to make socks for these baby blues. They come bringing recipes and gifts of homemade soap, a blueberry cookie jar, a straw hat from Hawaii. Sometimes they bring us lunch or a bag of cookies. Water or a jar or just canned jam. One time they even bring sushi. They offer us homemade blueberry beer or a mason jar moonshine filled with blueberries. We call it blue shine and sip it behind the shed. Usually they come early in the morning, but some come in the middle of the hottest afternoon to pick berries baking in their cars. Most use our buckets, but some come with their own cut-off milk jugs or special berry baskets. A few bring their own stools. One dowdy picker carries her purse into the field where she inspects her 1 pound harvest berry by berry. Her lanky husband waits by the checkout and cleans his pistol. Thankfully, they never return, and everyone else comes unarmed. Previous owners of our farm come, like Jesse Moore, surprised by a new road and pond. Or Mary Lewis, a spry woman in her 70s, who tells of her honeymoon working in this same field 60 years ago. She is amazed to pick berries where she once hoed corn. Older neighbors come. like Daniel Hughes, who drilled oats here in the early 1960s. He is the last farmer to work this land before the field was abandoned to pines. Some come wearing t-shirts proclaiming God is dead, and others hand us leaflets of doom. Sometimes they invite us to their houses of worship, or swimming holes, or geodesic domes. They come single or divorced, widow or bachelor, coupled, gay and straight, married and not. They come celebrating their 60th anniversary or their honeymoon, feeding each other gentle pinches of blue. On the day before their wedding, one couple picks for their reception, their eyes shining like each berry. They come crawling behind their parents or walking with canes or rolling in wheelchairs, a companion dog helping over the bump. Some who came regularly will never come again, like Greta, killed in a car wreck, or Tim at 40, who sucked away by skin cancer, or Ruby, whose generous heart laughs no more. At the end of the season, they come as gleaners for local soup kitchens, beating the Blue Jays for the last berries. We let them pick for free, and then close the gate, hanging a sign that reads, "Season's over. See you next year." And every day and every season, Sarah and I, we too come to this field as pickers, as pilgrims, as gleaners of whatever we find. But I really thought that was a beautiful book. It has you can tell he's a poet.
Yeah.
But where
is it set? If it's 3 hours from North Carolina.
Virginia.
Oh, Virginia. Okay.
In the hills of Virginia, in the real mountainy region. It says the county there. I don't remember what county it was.
But, yeah, no, that's
right. It was really nice. I'm not giving anything away by saying this. Because that's clear in the first page. I mean, tells you what the chapters are here and what everything is about, and it tells you, you know, how they got started with it, and then how it went running it, and then they eventually sell their farm, their blueberry farm, and go on somewhere else. But it was really nice to read. I believe it spanned, let's see, they started this in 1991. They planted it, planted all of them, and then they moved away in 2002. So they went at it hard for about 10 years there.
Yeah.
I really just enjoyed it. It was Southern and talked about a lot of things that I'm familiar with the whole organic growing process.
It's a good combination.
Yeah, it is. It is. It really, whenever you find something that resonates with you, it means a lot to you to find somebody that has been through some of the same things you've been through. So
I did.
I enjoyed it. And they have a lot of comical and funny things happen at the blueberry farm and some bad things too. So it was interesting. I did enjoy it. I'll say that. And it's got that, you can tell it's got that real lyrical flow to it. So anyway,
Sounds good. We went on a farm tour in North Carolina one summer, and one of the farms we went to was in kind of more of a mountainous region, and they were bringing back kind of the old terraced garden blueberry growing methods.
Wow.
Yeah, it was all organic. It was really incredible. And it was like tromping through the forest and then blueberries.
Wow.
I've never seen anything like it, you know.
It's nice whenever you can find, you know, folks still try to do stuff the old way. I mean, some new practices really work well.
But, oh, sure.
Yeah, but a lot of, you know, it's so bad whenever all these big-time farmers, and I know they have to do it, you know, to make their money and do what they got to do, but I just can't stand that when they go out and plant all these seeds and pour 10-10-10 on it and just fertilize it up so bad and then, you know, go out there and do it all again. That's not the way it was done back in the old days, and that's not the way I want to do it. So that it's really, it's a challenging thing, because most people are, you know, pretty up to date and it's on the board with the organic garden movement, but you still find some that are resistant, and you know, I'll just go throw some 10-10-10 and spray some chemicals around it. It'll be all right. So, so anyway, that those were my three, and I enjoyed your three too. They were,
yeah, no, you had great picks. I had only heard of one of those authors, so I always like learning about new ones.
Absolutely. Well, I'd only that U.S. Conductors. That was the only one of yours I'd heard about as well. So we kind of did a book share and discovery thing.
Yes, thank you for coming back on and everything.
Absolutely, I enjoy it. Thank you for letting me. I'm happy to be on anytime.
Woohoo! Thank you for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can find us at readingenvy.com.